Welcome to the Imagination Redeemed podcast. I'm Brian Brown. On this podcast, we seek to help you understand and live in the world like people of heaven. I'm pleased to let you know that we are hard at work planning our fourth season of content for the fall. And in the meantime, I have another bonus offering for you. I recently went on the Renew the Arts podcast with Michael Minkoff. Our friends at Renew the Arts are working to see patrons and artists partnered in communities to create art that enriches our lives, shapes our homes, and helps us love our neighbors. One great program they have is called Porchlight, which connects Christian musicians with a network of people around the country who are willing to host house concerts. When you get a chance, head over to renewthearts.org to check them out. In this conversation, Michael and I talk about living the life of the world to come and why imagination and art are so important in that pursuit. We also talk about Taylor Swift and The Dark Knight, obviously. Anyway, Michael kindly agreed to let me repost the episode here for you to enjoy, but definitely head over to Renew the Arts to subscribe to his podcast. Here's Michael.
I'm here with Brian Brown, who is the founder and the president of the Anselm Society, which is a organization dedicated to the renaissance of the Christian imagination. And he's been kind enough to come on here and talk to us a little bit. So thank you for coming on the podcast and for having this conversation with me.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. So first, I wanted you to tell me a little bit about the Anselm Society. Because in a lot of ways, your organization's actually has similar goals and even methods to ours here at Renew the Arts. So what does it mean for you to be dedicated to a renaissance of the Christian imagination? Like, explain that a little bit to me.
Yeah, I saw a quote from the British poet Malcolm Guite actually just earlier today. And he said that whenever you encounter something in the world, you can't just ask what it is. You have to ask what it means. And That's a function of the imagination. So what does it mean to have a Christian one? I think the easiest way that I've found to explain it is that we're all wrestling with the relationship between heaven and earth, between material stuff, including, you know, our own bodies, our embodied existence, and all of the other physical objects and people and whatnot that we bump up against in the world, and the spiritual dimension of that existence. And we live in a world where, on some level, materialism is the prevailing answer. The spiritual doesn't exist or is disconnected from the material, from reality as we experience it through our senses. And a lot of what has passed for Christianity in recent decades kind of has the same answer, that there's a spiritual world out there that has little to no connection to this material world. And that's left a lot of us with a lot of questions. Like, if I'm not a missionary, why does anything I do matter? Why does my vocation matter? Why do the things that I love most in the world, you know, my favorite songs or stories or food or something, do they matter? I think you could be forgiven in a lot of Christian circles for going through life assuming that some of that stuff that you value most in the world actually doesn't have a place in the kingdom of God. But Christian theology teaches a very different thing, that heaven and earth are actually very intimately tied up in each other. And there's nothing biological that's not theological. There's nothing that we encounter in the world that doesn't have a connection to the life of God. And as Christians, It's our task actually to not only pay attention and see that and study it, but also to call it out, to draw attention to it, and to actually join God in this world. He didn't put us in an embodied existence to keep us from him. He put us in an embodied existence to draw us to him. And then he joined us in that embodied existence in the incarnation. So I kind of answered the whole question in that little monologue there, in the sense that I'm describing a Christian imagination where we actually do want to kind of re-enchant our notion of reality. We want to see that heavenly dimension in things and figure out how to participate in it. And it needs a renaissance, because what I've just described is normal run-of-the-mill Christian theology as recently as the early 1800s in almost any denomination you can think of. But we've kind of forgotten it.
So this might be an extended rabbit trail, but why do you think that shifted or changed?
Yeah, at some point I want someone that's not me to do the research on exactly that question and write the scholarly book. But in fact, I stayed up late with some friends debating this, and we were just speculating. But let me put it in terms of something concrete. And this runs the risk of annoying a lot of people. So,
okay, feel free.
Hopefully we can have some fun. Is Christ present in the bread and wine when we take communion? The Catholic and Orthodox answer is that he is physically present. The bread and wine cease to be bread and wine and become the body and blood. Historically, though, the Protestant answer, in literally any denomination you can think of, was yes, he is present. The actual physical elements are a means of grace. Mm-hmm. They're not just something by which we remember an act of grace in the past. And for us, it's speaking as a Protestant, he's spiritually present.
Right. Well, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about that, because even that concept of spiritual, even though people will pay it lip service, and it's very important, but it almost has, I think, a connotation or a practical effect with a lot of people of meaning not real.
Yeah.
That to say that it is spiritually present is almost in some way to demote it from reality into some sort of abstraction. And can you speak to that a little bit? Because in some sense, that is a problem of the imagination. Even the idea of the imagination being something that produces unreal things and that considers unreal things, whereas your concept of the Christian imagination is actually using it in order to see the unseen things, which are not unreal things. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think the easiest way that for me to understand it has simply been that you can think of, if you think of everything that God has made as almost a letter to us, that the creation itself is the first book almost that he wrote to us, telling us about him, which is why the second book, the actual Holy Scriptures, refer to nature so much, assuming that we're paying attention
that
to
you
it.
Know. Yeah.
And in that book, that the creation that he's made, his fingerprints are all over it. It's pointing to something. It's pointing to the nature of God. It's also pointing to the nature of what we call heaven. Mm-hmm. And if we think of the two as being related in the following sense, it starts to make more sense. The heavenly things are the archetypes, the version of whatever the thing is in question that maybe we can't, as finite beings, wrap our heads around just yet. Mm-hmm. But the thing we experience in the world points us to that and gives us a shadow of that. So an easy one would be, I mean, we were talking about the Eucharist, but food in general. Mm-hmm. Food in general is an experience of need and having that need met. It's an experience of taking in something that is not me to give me life. Mm-hmm. You can see a fairly obvious spiritual dimension to that. But there's layers and layers to it. There's also the way that that is preparing me for feasting in heaven, for the supper of the Lamb. There's hints in scripture that thing I'm experiencing in the here and now has a twin that is the fully realized version of eating.
And that things are moving from that direction toward us.
Yeah. So if you just think of it,
yeah.
and you can get it wrong by thinking of it in terms of the physical things and trying to understand heaven as a result, right? You could, like, oh, I really like beer. The beer must be better in heaven, right? As opposed to, there's a thing in heaven that I'm not fully ready for, that I don't fully understand. And this thing that I'm experiencing here is a shadow of it. Mm-hmm. I can go the wrong direction. I can get away from Christianity by denying either end of it, right? By saying the material end of it doesn't really matter. And by saying the spiritual end of it is less real.
Right. Yeah. And I think that we're more in the latter part of that than the former. In some ways, I think probably in reaction to materialism, which has oddly just made the material world free from spiritual meaning, which people are like, well, if it's free from spiritual meaning, then church doesn't really have any meaning either, because you separate those out into these two hemispheres. And what I do at church and what I do with God and whatever else is just sort of a thing on this side. And then everything I do in the world is a thing on this side.
Yeah.
Even though they would say heaven is so much more important and spiritual reality is so much more important. But because there's this implied understanding that they're not real, they're not really working for or even understanding the meaning, like you said, of what things mean here on earth through the lens of heaven gives shape to and meaning to these material things. I think we've freed ourselves in some sense from the pagan idea of saying that what we have on earth is heaven. The pagan idea is in heaven as it is on earth. Or in some sense, heaven is a picture of what earth is. Like if you look at like pagan ideas, the gods in some sense are subject to the way things quote unquote are, as opposed to saying, you know, God's will is larger than and supervening over the rhythms and movements of nature.
Yeah. I mean, you can see this in any, almost any religion, you know, think of like the old Norse religions, the
exactly.
Vikings and whatnot, right? It's like,
totally.
Well, what is heaven like? It's exactly like earth, but better.
Bigger.
We feast in the great mead hall here, and we're going to go to the great to Valhalla and have the great mead hall there. Yeah.
Right.
So in terms of everyday living, right, the implication of that is, well, how do you quote unquote get to heaven? How do you live well? Well, you do what you would have done anyway, and you'll get to do that forever. Yay.
Yes.
And Christianity's answer is very different, that
absolutely.
We live in a fallen world that pushes us away from the way we were actually made to live. And why we are here as Christians is to actually make the earth conform more closely through Christ
to heaven.
To heaven.
Correct. Yeah. So that's a great segue into one of my second questions, which is what has the Anselm Society done to go about this work of Renaissance?
I think that you can probably think of the through line as we want to help people see, learn, and live in this sacramental way of looking at the world. And I haven't used that that big word yet, but that's really what we're talking about. Something where we're saying heaven and earth actually have something to do with each other, and how I live now has in some way has eternal significance. So what does it mean to see the world that way? Well, that requires inspiration. That requires somebody to come along and do something for me that I maybe wouldn't think of if I were just reading a science textbook in terms of how I understand the world. It's back to the Malcolm Guite quote. I'm not just looking for what something is. I want to find out what it means. And with that, you have that next dimension of, I want to learn. I want to go deeper. This human instinct to understand is an incredibly important one. If it's the pursuit of God that that's driving all of it. And then how do you live according to that? So everything that we've done over the years, lectures and courses and conferences and things like that, just, you know, longer conversations like this one that are designed to expose people to what is in fact Orthodox Christianity. But what most of us didn't grow up with. But also a lot of it is about helping each other live that way, live like the kind of weirdos who would write songs and sing them together and tell stories of ages past and write new stories in that tradition and do the kinds of things as far as rhythms and the ways that we make meaning together to tell each other and to teach our children that larger nature of reality.
Right. And we do have this specialized concept of those things. I mean, we do all of those things in church. Sing together, hear somebody talk to us a little bit, get some new information. We do that, but we consider that to be an odd and special thing. What you're talking about is to make that kind of Sunday experience, rather than a specialized, formalized thing, more of an informal fabric of life type thing. Receiving beauty together, beholding beauty together, eating together, fellowshipping together, considering these things together, learning about these things. And when we were talking recently, you mentioned how often people at Anselm Society gatherings will mention something along the lines of, I wonder if this is what heaven will be like, which is sort of why we're talking about this, because I was like, that's a really interesting idea. I want to talk more about that. I'm thinking church services are supposed to feel like that, like a little taste of heaven on earth, but they feel so alien and so strange to us because it's almost like we go from life as we're used to it to this other thing that our lives are not really made for. And it just feel, again, you end up having that split hemisphere type idea that like have spiritual life on Sunday and the rest of my life, the rest of the week. And so in some ways, I'm guessing what you're saying is Anselm Society is attempting to bridge that gap and in some ways make those supernatural experiences more natural. Why do you think your gatherings inspire that thought so much, though?
I think you nailed it. I mean, the way that you just framed that, I think if you were to go to a typical kind of evangelical Protestant and say heaven is like what you do on Sunday at church. I mean, I for one don't find that all that appealing. Right? I mean, if the image is I'm going to sing very, very passionate emotional songs and listen to information being given to me. Yeah, it feels like this weird extra category of thing that I do because of some sense of that I'm supposed to, that has no connection to the rest of life, except insofar as, and here's the $1 million phrase, I can apply it to my life.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I encounter that a ton with, not just when I'm speaking, but when I, organize events at which other people are speaking, there's a certain kind of person that's always asking that, how do I apply this to my life question? The implication being, if I've just experienced some new and important idea, if I can't copy and paste it onto a new set of behaviors, I don't know what to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think, I mean, of all the authors that have tried to articulate what we're talking about, my favorite is Alexander Schmemann in his little book For the Life of the World, which is literally the whole book is just, yeah, that thing you do on Sunday morning, it's supposed to bleed into everything else, not in the sense that you're so just sort of generically pious and prayerful all the time, or because you're slightly better behaved than everybody else. But because, yeah, you are doing a feast on Sunday, and you are worshiping and praising on Sunday, and you are delving into the character of God on Sunday. And all of that is supposed to characterize the rest of your life. So what we try to do with an event, and we do a lot more than events, but we find that events, both big and small, can be good little microcosms, little pictures of the whole thing. Cause you can walk in and, man, these people seem to value food more than I did when I was in the drive-thru at McDonald's yesterday.
Correct.
And they seem to value all these sorts of meaning making together. So, I mean, let's make this concrete. A couple months ago, we had a St. Patrick's Day. We call them pub nights. Mm-hmm. And we just got together, rented out the top floor of an Irish pub, but we've also done these in homes and church fellowship halls and all kinds of stuff, all kinds of places. And we told stories, from the story of St. Patrick and related to Irish Christian history and mythology. And we sang songs. Some of them were performances, but most of them were participatory. Just singing songs for fun. Some of them were more of a hymn kind of variety, and others were just for fun, right? They're just singing through the culture. And people are just kind of looking around at each other. They're eating great food. They're drinking great drinks. They're bonding with old and new friends, and they're finding that this kind of meaning making over food, there's just something human about it. Mm-hmm. And they're looking at each other, especially the first timers, are looking around at each other like, I think that's where the, is this what heaven is like comes from? Because when you sing together, I mean, this is well documented scientifically. When you sing together, it actually bonds you. It actually makes you feel closer to the people you're singing with, especially if you're mm-hmm. singing something that is engaging you and pushing you towards something that you all value and love. Mm-hmm. And there's something different about listening to a story together and being able to remember, you know, that time that we all heard so-and-so tell the legend of whatever. It's different than the privatized experience of watching Netflix by myself or reading a book by myself. There's something about coming together like that.
Why is it so different? I've been wondering about this a lot because especially with us, we do a lot of work trying to get people to engage with the arts. And I know what you're talking about, and I think you're right, but why is it so different? Why is it so much different watching a movie, even watching a movie in a theater with other people? You're not saying anything. You're just mm-hmm. bodies next to bodies in the darkness of a theater watching it together. Why is that such a different experience? And it is. But why do you think it's such a different experience than watching the same movie by myself at home on my phone with my, you know, earphones on or whatever? Why is it so significantly different? Not just scale, but there's something about being with people.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Well, let's stick with the movie example. If you're just watching some okay movie and you're watching it because it happened to open this weekend or something and nobody's all that impressed by it, then, you know, maybe it isn't all that, all that different. And I think Hollywood's kind of learning that the hard way as people's habits have changed, and you're mm-hmm. only going to go to a movie in the movie theater now, unless you, if you think it's going to be something special. But you know, the difference between watching Star Wars on my iPad and being in the theater in 1980 with 200 other people hearing, "No, I am your father," together and mm-hmm. all gasping, mm-hmm. or more recently sitting in Avengers Endgame mm-hmm. At the climax and everybody's cheering and everybody's going, "Yeah, we've been waiting mm-hmm. 10 years for this moment over mm-hmm. the course of 20 stories." Mm-hmm. When you're experiencing that story for the first time, you kind of remember where you were when you experienced it, but only if you experienced it with other people. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, there's a value to repetition. There's a value to, "Oh, tell us that old story again." Mm-hmm. To take that one step further with more naturally participatory art forms, like say music performed live. I mean, let's say you go to a Taylor Swift concert. Part of the reason that Taylor Swift is so popular is that she is putting into words, especially for women, particularly universal experiences that they've all experienced separately. Mm-hmm. They've lived their lives separately. They've experienced things that are common to their generation and their sex. And in that stadium, in that arena, all of a sudden, in a far more powerful way than when they were just listening to it on their earbuds, they're all brought together mm-hmm. through this song that's singing their story.
But well, and they sing it together too. I
mean, and they sing it together.
That's part of the thing. Yeah. You go to a concert and everybody's singing a lot of those songs.
So I think you can have those two dimensions. Like the first dimension is, can the artist put something into words in a way that is so personal and so specific that it's universal, right? It's my story. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden I feel together. I feel united with all these people I've never met before. There's another dimension to it though. And this is where you can get into something more like the house concert kind of vibe or hymn sings and those kinds of things. There's an even more powerful dimension to that that's incredibly rare to experience now, which is the experience where instead of putting something into words that we've all experienced separately, and therefore making us feel, even if it's just for a moment, like we're all united, telling a story or singing a song that puts into words a shared experience we've all had together. There's not enough art that's being created out of the shared life of a community. And that's mm-hmm. part of the reason that we don't have communities with shared lives.
Right.
They kind of go hand in hand, but in mm-hmm. that healthy communal dynamic, you can have those musicians, for example, who are writing that song about that tragedy you all went through together, or that time when God was faithful, when you didn't think he was going to come through and you were all there. Mm-hmm. And, or maybe your grandparents were there and they're, mm-hmm. and you're all singing that song and remembering it together. That's the real thing mm-hmm. that is that, that extra layer, that extra, dimension of truth. We're actually bonded together in a reality, not just in an illusion, that we are mm-hmm. a real community and we are really experiencing this together. And we're really, remembering who we are. Those are both right. beautiful layers, but they're more and more and more rare, which is mm-hmm. why when somebody comes along and nails it, either through sort of a generation defining artist like Taylor Swift, or whether it's, mm-hmm. Something like a hymn sing where you're all going, we all know these songs. These are songs about us. Mm-hmm. That it's just far more powerful than anything that I could listen to on my phone at home.
I think you're right. And I think a lot of people would even listen to what you're saying and saying, yes, but that's not hugely important. Right. Especially if you haven't experienced it.
If you haven't experienced it. Yeah.
Yeah. Because the promise that we have from the American dream or whatever is that each person can pursue his own individual purposes and pleasures and be largely fulfilled in those things without help or assistance from anybody else.
Yeah.
It is a lie. It's a weird one though, because in some ways it's self-fulfilling. Like if you do pursue that, you just think that that's the best that it gets. And maybe that's one of the reasons why all these people have never experienced the kind of community belonging, togetherness, the feeling of communal meaning making, why they feel like, oh, this is a different level of life. I mean, I've been living in a space station and now I've come to Earth. So maybe a lot of people listening to this, and I know I've heard this a million times, is that yes, but that additional layer, that additional pleasure, that additional connection, that additional meaning making is superfluous. Not necessary, not essential. And so there's been a erosion of the sense of art as essential to human flourishing.
Yeah.
And an idea that art is an extra, you know, luxury, superfluous, but not necessary, not essential, not something that we should actually be investing in heavily. Do you think art is essential or superfluous? Like, what's your take on that?
Yeah, I think the best thing that I can think of to compare it to is any mode of learning. I mean, imagine the thing that you enjoy most in all the world. And imagine if no one and nothing had ever challenged you to master it. Mm-hmm. So let's say you're a huge film buff and mm-hmm. you never progressed past Blue's Clues. Mm. And this is the way that C.S. Lewis talks about heaven. It's not that pleasure is a bad thing. It's that we're too easily pleased. Mm-hmm. And we think we're sitting there playing with mud pies, thinking mm-hmm. that's as good as it gets because we can't fathom what a day at the seaside would be like. Mm-hmm. And I'll never know what I'm missing. But the problem is with life, not just with art, that's not what we're made for. It's the art version of saying I'm enough. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, that's the mantra of so much of social media. You are enough. You just need to learn to love yourself. No, you're not enough.
Right.
And, you know, I think it was Annie Dillard who said that the miracle, the amazing thing about God is that he loves us exactly the way we are. And he loves us too much to let us stay this way.
Right? Yeah.
Like right. You were made to actually surrender the aspects of yourself that you think you can't live without. Mm-hmm. Over the course of a lifetime, and in the process become something that God intends you to be that's way better than you've ever imagined.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that we have been working on a lot is how do we expand our boundaries and our conception of what could be joyful? Like you said, if I'm as happy with mud pies as I could be, maybe it's because my capacity for happiness needs a little expansion. And in some ways, that goes back to our initial talk about renaissance of the Christian imagination. To bring a change or renewal, a growth to the boundaries of what you could be happy with. Why not pursue an expanded experience? Why be satisfied with all of these limitations and all of this mediocrity? And I haven't really solved that exactly, but I do think that the pursuit of God and the pursuit of righteousness is a pursuit of a higher meaning and a larger life, and a life that's beyond just pain and pleasure, a life that surpasses mere animal existence. That's what we are destined for in Christ, is a participation in the divine nature. This life is supposed to be a workshop for becoming fit for that life, right? So we titled this podcast episode, Looking for the Life of the World to Come, because that is one of the things we say we believe or that we're looking for in the Nicene Creed when we give this communal confession that's been around for, 1800 years at this point. We say that we are looking for the life of the world to come. And I've always thought about that in terms of not just that I am waiting for it, that I am anticipating the life of the world to come, but also that I am looking for it here. And so again, that I'm trying to see how the life to come is invading the life here. Where is it? Where do I find it? Look around like, oh, look, there's the life of the world to come right there. I see it. I see it. A little image of it, a glimpse of it, through this pinhole or whatever, that is the arts, or that is these communal experiences. If it is like that, and if it is true, right, if this is true, and I think it is, that art and especially art within communities and shared meaning making are essential to human flourishing, which I think they are, and they have the power to give us a taste of heaven, which I think they do, and they're perhaps they could even shape and correct us into righteous, more Christ-like people. Why then are the arts and arts communities so regularly underappreciated? Why are they so dismissed? Why are they sometimes even feared in many Christian circles? Like, what? Why? Yeah. I don't even get it. Why aren't they appreciated?
Yeah, there's a lot of dimensions to that question, I think. But I mean, here's a couple that come to mind. One is what we started with. It's what I'd say 3/4 plus of American Protestants grew up with as Christianity, which is the version that at least implicitly says the here and now doesn't matter. Getting in the elevator, going up for the next life is what matters. And vocations and activities toward that end are what matters. Okay, well, if you have an explanation of reality that says 98% of human activity is irrelevant to God, that means that the only way you have to value anything in that category is if it's essential to survival. Right? I must eat. I can't justify feasting, but I must eat.
Right.
Or to sort of categorize it as a guilty pleasure, right? I know it's not really important, but I can't quite get away from the fact that I like it.
I like it. But maybe you feel guilty about it too.
Yes. That's why there's a long tradition in America of making things into sins that are not sins.
Right.
You shouldn't dance and you shouldn't drink, and like things that are not condemned in scripture that are condemned as sins because we have nowhere else to put them. They're either irrelevant and unimportant and therefore at best a distraction, or they're actively harmful because I have nowhere else to put them.
Right.
So even if you didn't come from a more fundamentalist background, where you've probably experienced this as a typical Protestant or even Catholic, is at least that your churchy friends only seem to value art that is oriented towards what, Sunday worship or conversion, getting people in the elevator going up. So you get people funding so-called Christian movies that are just there to be morality tales or to tell a conversion story. By contrast, if you have an explanation of reality like we've been talking about, all of a sudden, the things that inspire us toward the life of heaven, that help us understand God better, that help us understand human existence better, all of a sudden become incredibly important.
And incredibly broad. You can find those all over the place. You can find those in historical examples, stories, physical realities, creational, parallels and whatever.
Even something that perhaps asks a really good question, but
yeah,
can't quite
doesn't
answer
give an
it.
Answer. Yeah.
Right. Like what's there's the great question raised in Christopher Nolan's movie, The Dark Knight, about the nature of evil. And he doesn't fully answer the question of like, what is good in response to that evil. There's a lot of ambiguity and a lot of room for questioning, but it's one of the most honest looks at evil that you'll ever see. And it bears paying attention to, because a Christian has more of an answer to that question, but the level of depth at which the question is asked demands a level of depth in the answer that you wouldn't get if you were just, you know, if your 6-year-old just said, you know, Daddy, what is evil?
No, you're right. And I wouldn't necessarily have a 6-year-old watch The Dark Knight, but I might have them read a story that is similarly troubling or disturbing. You know, and a lot of fairy tales and things like that are so that way. And why are they that way? Well, I think, and this is the thing, is like the church is filled with answers for questions no one's asking anymore. Yep. And that if you cannot get people to recognize the importance of the question, in an urbane civilized society, what does evil even mean? Right. But you look at it, you watch a movie like Dark Knight and you're like, oh, okay, this actually rings true to a large portion of human psychology. I am compelled by this story. And this actually does seem to resonate with me. But then it leads me to this question. What is the answer to that?
And there's a dimension to this that I think is really important. Another dimension, which is more sort of closer to home, a little more practical, which is simply that in the last 100 years since the advent of recording equipment and radio and everything that has come since technologically, the experience of encountering any type of art is very individualized, very privatized, mm-hmm. very disembodied mm-hmm. to a significant extent, and consumerized.
Yeah.
Right. Totally. So there's this category of person.
Consumer. Yeah.
Yeah. Like there's this category of person called an artist, and he's the person who, in the case of music, has a recording deal with a record label, or is trying to make it through going viral on YouTube and Spotify and whatnot. But it's this separate category of person that's over there. And if I'm not that category of person, then by default, I am this other category of person called a consumer. In the same way that I'm a consumer of fast food, or a consumer of my car is a consumer of gasoline or anything else. And it's a totally different experience from a world where maybe some of the art you're experiencing is created by people you know. You are in a room with a singer-songwriter who's writing a song. You're building a relationship with them, perhaps. You are supporting them financially. You're praying for them. You're getting to see the version of the song before it's finished and give them feedback on it. You are singing along with them. Those lines start to blur. And because we weren't made to be consumers, we were made to be creators. We are created in the image of a creator. And so even if I don't consider myself an artist in that first sense, that hyper-professionalized sense, I'm somebody who can play a role in meaning-making with other people who have a gift roles. That I don't have, or another role. If that's all experienced in that relational kind of way, that changes my relationship to, you know, any art form that I can encounter that way. And it becomes something that I can make mine. This is all art as life, as opposed to art as something I consume. And it's a much deeper, richer thing.
I totally agree with you. And I mean, your organization has been about it. Ours has been about it for a long time as well. It's a challenging work to present something to people that they haven't yet imagined. Those people, I think, who have taken that step of faith to experience it, to extend themselves in these directions and be vulnerable to the possibility of these things, they've responded to you and responded to us as well, that this was a very beautiful and unexpected thing that feels almost heavenly, feels almost otherworldly, how wonderful and how meaningful, how significant these things can be.
I think there's a crucial dimension there too, where the point isn't to say, oh, that cheap wine that you like is, you know, that sucks. You know, what a burger sucks. I'm not saying your favorite thing sucks. I'm saying, hey, try this. If you like that, you might really like this.
It's also the case, and I guess this is just the way that we are. I don't mind if someone tells me that my taste needs to be improved. Our last podcast was that, why your taste needs to be better, right. Basically, and how to improve it. I think that's part of the thing, too, is that it does take humility to pursue these things. Ultimately, I'm comparing myself to myself and to a standard of perfection. And I know that I want to grow. I want to always be growing from what I used to be, because life is growth. If you're not growing, you're dead. What am I growing towards? This perfect standard. What does that perfect standard include? Excellence and great care and high consideration. If I can't tell the difference between something that took a huge amount of effort, a huge amount of training, a huge amount of skill, and something that could be made by a pre-high school graduate on a grill at a fast food restaurant, if I can't tell the difference between these two things, I should learn to be able to tell the difference.
Yeah, absolutely. The first step of any kind of mastery is submission.
Yeah.
And absolutely. There are a lot of people who want to be good people and a lot of artists that want to be good artists that don't grow because they don't recognize that.
Absolutely. I tell all my kids this. I was like, you really have two choices. You can either be stupid or look stupid. You got to choose one, because in order to stop being stupid, you're going to have to look stupid quite a bit, actually. Yep. And that's okay. Get used to it. It's fine. It doesn't matter. Much, much better to look stupid and not be stupid than to be stupid and not look stupid.
Yep. Yeah. It took me like 25, 30 years to figure that one out. And too, I can look back too. At so many, like so much of college was wasted on me because I didn't want to look stupid. And
yeah.
Yeah. And so much I would have learned if I'd been willing to, you know, go to office hours with the professors and just ask them the dumb questions and listen.
Mm. That was great. Thank you, Brian, so much for coming on the podcast. I want to conclude the podcast by asking you just one final question. Who knows? This might be 10 or 15 more minutes out of you if you have a lot on it. But what do you think are some of the most primary ways people can look for the life of the world to come? And for the sake of this question, I want you to assume that people don't have Anselm Society meetings in their area and that they don't know anything at all about Renew the Arts or Porchlight or any of the kind of guidepost type things. Like they're on their own, let's say. What do you think? Here are some things. Here are the most primary important things people could do to cultivate communities generously pursuing beauty in the arts.
I'd probably frame it in terms of inputs and outputs. Okay. So with inputs, ask yourself that question of what am I taking in
already?
And what can I be taking in? And again, boy, does this require sacrifice, right? Sometimes I get to the end of the day and I'm just tired. And, you know, vegging in front of Netflix sounds like the most attractive thing in the world. I also know that after 2 hours of that, I probably will not be a better person than I was at the beginning of it. And I have to be willing to at least take some of those moments, those evenings and go, I'm going to try reading that hard book, or I'm going to listen to that podcast from that wiser person. And there are podcasts like this one, with the Anselm Society. We're trying to get better at building a set of kind of foundational resources that you could come to and, all right, where do I start? Well, you could start here. We have our own couple of podcasts, Believe to See and Redeemed Imagination, that work towards those ends. And, you know, who are you keeping company with? Not in terms of like the, you know, shed anybody that you think is not pushing you forward or something like that. You know, that's silly, but in the sense of, are there people either literally in your church, in your family, in your community, or sort of figuratively in terms of you're reading their books, they're worth admiring. You're not following them just because they say the things you already agree with on YouTube.
Correct.
They're actually challenging you to think more deeply. But I think the danger is that a lot of people stop there. They stop with the inputs, and the best they can manage is to continue to become a more and more thoughtful, more and more knowledgeable piece of irrelevance. Because you need to have outputs. You need to be willing to then put that somewhere. And often the hardest thing is just to take one small step, find one other person that you could say, get coffee with once a month and talk about what you're thinking, what you're reading, ask each other hard questions, dive into answers together. I have one friend who wanted something like Renew the Arts, like Anselm, where they were. And she got as far as, well, I have a living room and I have a couple friends I think would be interested, and I'm just going to start a periodic, you know, quarterly, if something like monthly or weekly scares you off, a thing where we all bring food, and it's a salon type thing where you're just, you know, anybody who wants to can share something. Hey, I read this great poem from Emily Dickinson and I'm going to read it. Or, you know, listening to a song together and talking about what you heard and what it meant to you, right? Requires no specialized expertise, requires no mastery, requires nothing other than a desire to grow and help others grow by sharing hospitality. And it might be literally in your living room hospitality, or it might just be the act of saying, I will be at this coffee shop at this time. And I love talking about fill in the blank. If anybody wants to join. I think, you know, I call it planting a flag, just saying, I care about this. If anybody else cares about this, here's a mechanism I've created for you to join me. I've never yet met somebody who tried something like that and wasn't surprised at the result, at how many people came out of the woodwork and said, I thought I was the only one.
Well, that's good. That was really good, Brian. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast and for having me on your podcast. I really appreciate the conversation and the work that you're doing. How can people connect with the Anselm Society?
Yeah, for now we're on at anselmsociety.org, A-N-S-E-L-M society.org. We're on Instagram, we're on Facebook, are dangerously close to being on Substack, I think in the next few weeks. And we've got, two podcasts of our own. Belief to See is, we call it the fun one. It's the one where just you're kind of sitting down for coffee or a glass of wine with people who love to talk about this sort of thing and enjoy it. And then our Imagination Redeemed podcast is more of the theological deep dives and answers to the hard questions kinds of things. And we're currently planning, we have three seasons of that under our belt, and we're currently planning the next one. So yeah, excellent. Whether it's social media or signing up for the email lists on our website or following us on their favorite podcast, those are all great ways to plug in.
And you mostly do in-person meetings and gatherings in the Colorado Springs area?
Yes, almost entirely. But we try to film and record as much as we can. So a lot of our past archives, just lectures from all kinds of crazy people, are on our website there to be enjoyed. Okay.
And if somebody wanted to start an Anselm Society type thing in their area, could they potentially contact you and get help organizing something like that?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a contact us form on our website, and we've got several sister or maybe daughter organizations that have started that just started with somebody saying, hey, I want something like this where I am. Can we compare notes?
Okay, awesome. That's excellent. Thank you, Brian. All right. Well, thank you to loyal listeners for sticking with us for all these years. And we'll see you next time.